The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Jonathan Weiner. I used to have to deal with human rights and law enforcement issues all the time when I was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for International Law Enforcement in the Clinton administration, when things were much easier than they are now and we didn't face fundamental threats to human rights and fundamental threats to law enforcement at the same time, both of which I think we're seeing as a result of the confrontation over these issues that's playing out in the area of sanctions. We have with us this afternoon a really terrific panel of people who can provide an outside perspective, as going to be provided by Patrick Keefe, who writes for The New Yorker and books on this topic and has looked at the intersection of intelligence and law and human rights in a lot of different contexts, from immigration to terrorism to organized crime. We're then going to hear from Ori Lev, who's going to go through how the courts have handled sanctions in the United States and how it's played out. Going beyond sanctions, I would note that we've had a difficult time in the United States sustaining successful legal criminal cases against people for whom there's a great deal of information have been involved in terrorist finance. And that's interesting, because it does suggest that when you get into a court's judicial setting, some of the kinds of information governments get don't translate very well for jury cases. And I remember when I was in the government having information which I had gotten from a very secret part of the United States government, in which a very serious criminal, among the worst criminals that I encountered in my work in the world, discussed various people he was going to murder. And there wasn't any question that what he was talking about, and he wasn't joking about it. He was going to murder these people, and we then had other intelligence showing people going around the planet trying to kill the people who he said he wanted to murder. And we talked about designating this person. We didn't, ultimately, because of the question, if we designated, how much of this information would we have to put out and make public? And the person wasn't designated, although they are a serious criminal, and they are actually the subject of multiple indictments and multiple clients, this person and some of his associates. So it's very, very tricky stuff. We're then going to hear from Christopher Michelson, who's going to give us a, from the University of New South Wales in Sydney, who's going to give us an assessment of the global regime and the legal challenges. And he and I talked over lunch, and he thinks there is a strong need for some due process to push back governments which have been unconstrained by law. I think that's a fair characterization of where he comes from in the first instance. But he's also going to provide descriptive as well as descriptive summaries of where things are, as well as his perspective. I'll then have some observations and questions after they're done, and then we'll open it up to all of you. People should also feel free at the end of the speakers, if there's an absolutely urgent question before I open my mouth again, to go for it. It's okay. And if it's absolutely super urgent, do it even. You can even interrupt a speaker. That has been known to happen. This is not an authoritarian regime inside of American University. And with that, I turn to Pat Keefe.
Thanks very much. Thank you, Jonathan, and thanks for having me. I'm pleased to be here today. A few years ago, I wrote a book about signals intelligence, and as I was doing my research and going around talking to people about this very mysterious and secretive subject, I arrived at a rule of thumb, which has proved durable in the years since, which is that there's an inverse proportion between how much someone talks about intelligence and how much they actually know about it. With that in mind, I'll try and keep this brief. What I'm going to talk about is actually fairly specific, and the reason I come to this is that I wrote a long article for The New Yorker magazine earlier this year about one particular case, which was the case of an international Islamic charity based in Saudi Arabia, the Al Haramain Islamic Foundation. Al Haramain, while it was operational, had a presence in some 50 countries, an annual budget of perhaps as much as $50 million, and in the years following September 11th, about a dozen foreign branches of Al Haramain were designated by OFAC. And ultimately in 2004, The small U.S. presence, the U.S. branch, was designated as well. That was a small office run out of Oregon. And there was an interesting exchange, which I think will kind of highlight some of these issues involving intelligence, when the designation was first pending, when the assets were initially frozen and OFAC was conducting its investigation. Lawyers for Al-Haramain got in touch with OFAC and essentially said, what do you have? Where's the proof? Show us the evidence that would indicate that there's an affiliation or a link or support with terrorism for this organization. And OFAC turned over a series of documents, in many cases, news reports, sort of public source information, and said, look, there's also a classified record, but we're not in a position to furnish you with that. And Al-Haramain kind of rabble-roused and said, no, you have to give us the whole record. And OFAC said, no, we won't. We can't give you the classified stuff. And then in the third mailing of supporting evidence, in an apparent clerical error, OFAC included a log of telephone conversations that had been intercepted by the National Security Agency between some of Al-Haramain's employees and some of their attorneys in Washington, D.C., a bit of a blunder. Al-Haramain used that log to then try and challenge the grounds for their designation and also to sue the Bush administration, arguing that it had proof of the warrantless wiretapping program. That's a suit which has gone on. We can talk about it in the Q&A if you like. It's somewhat irrelevant here, but so far they've been unsuccessful. The OFAC designation is a powerful and I think really valuable tool available to the government in pursuing terrorists and those who support them. It's very different from a law enforcement approach, as was discussed this morning, and I'm sure we'll continue to discuss this afternoon. There's the fact that you can actually freeze assets pending the investigation rather than once it's concluded. There's the fact that in putting together the evidentiaries for an OFAC designation, Treasury is able to rely on a much broader range of evidence than you would necessarily in bringing a criminal prosecution. So you can bring in hearsay, you can bring in newspaper articles, media reports, what have you. And then there's also the fact that this is to some extent conducted in secrecy. The actual evaluation of the grounds for carrying out a designation are to some extent carried out in a black box. As in the case with Al-Haramain, OFAC will turn over information, anything public source, in order to bolster the action. But then there will often be additional information, classified evidence, which they won't reveal. The problem here is that this obviously brings us into conflict with a really fundamental element of the rule of law in the U.S., which is this principle that the accused should have the ability and the right to confront the evidence against him. And so as a result, you're really looking at a situation in which there's a great deal of discretion being exercised by Treasury with these designations. Now, by all accounts, the process has grown much more rigorous in the years since 9/11 as these designations have proliferated. But there does seem to be some indication that particularly early on, in 2001, 2002, the process was characterized less by rigor than by haste. David Aufhauser, who was the general counsel to Treasury at the time, said of this period, it was almost comical. We just listed out as many of the usual suspects as we could and said, let's go freeze some assets. Another official who was involved in the process had a sort of memorable turn of phrase. He said, we were so forward-leaning, we nearly fell on our face. Because we're not in a position, those of us outside the government, to see the actual evidentiaries, it's very difficult for us to evaluate how fair this process is. It may be, just one second. It's difficult for us to evaluate just how fair the process is. Critics, in looking at these cases, have identified a pattern, particularly in the U.S., and particularly as it relates with cases that relate to Islamic charities. The pattern is essentially that there will be a designation, and it will be announced that there are links to a terrorist group or a terrorist entity. And then sometime later, there may, after the designation, be a criminal prosecution brought by the Department of Justice. But in many of those cases, the actual criminal charges don't relate to terrorism. There'll be lesser charges on the basis of tax violations or immigration violations. The argument that the Justice Department makes is essentially what Jonathan was getting at, You know, in some cases, these are very difficult charges. Material support claims, charges, for instance, are very difficult to bring before a jury. In other cases, there is secret evidence that cannot be revealed. And that instead, there's another technique being employed here, which is actually somebody I interviewed for the piece referred to this as Al Caponing people. You essentially get them on what you can get them on. Critics of the process claim that this amounts to pretextual prosecutions, that essentially when you have a failure to bring terrorism charges following a designation that alleges actual ties to terrorism, that basically is, it's, the government has had an opportunity to show its hand and it doesn't, which sort of then leads to the suggestion that they might have been bluffing and that there may not have actually been sufficient evidence for the designation even, which is something that we're not in a position to review because we can't see the original information. I think one way to explain this disconnect, actually, between the designations on the one hand and the criminal prosecutions on the other is actually if you think about the role of intelligence, particularly in the battle against terrorism, and in the domestic effort to identify terrorist cells or those who are supporting them within the United States. If you think about radicalization is a process through which extreme religious or political ideologies may eventually blossom into violent action. And the role of intelligence, in some ways, is to try and figure out who is where along that process and try and avert that blossoming from actually happening. If you're an intelligence agency, the way in which you do that is you come up with proxies to try and sort of figure out what it is you should be looking for. And I think very often those are going to be speech, ideology, religious belief, association. The problem with bringing this into a criminal context in the United States is that those are all categories protected under the First Amendment. Some might argue that OFAC designations actually allow for a way around that, that you can look at a situation where, for instance, in the case of Al-Haramain, you have a small entity in Oregon that's distributing quite radical literature. Now, you're not necessarily going to be in a position to prosecute Al-Haramain on those grounds, but it might very well be, depending on where that literature is coming from, which imams are coming into the country and cycling through, that you can get an OFAC designation, which would be a way of essentially putting them out of business or disrupting what they're doing. The problem, I think, with this is that, in a way, either way, if you're looking at the individuals in question, it's not a very satisfactory solution. So if you have a criminal prosecution, as was the case in Al-Haramain, where eventually charges were brought against one of the leaders of Al-Haramain, Oregon, and they were tax charges. Now, if we truly believe that this person has direct links to Osama bin Laden, or that his organization does, and you actually take him up on tax charges, this to me doesn't seem like a very satisfactory solution, because ultimately he's going to get a token sentence if he is convicted, and you want him to be away for longer. If, on the other hand, the situation is that he has beliefs which, though they may be repugnant to us, are protected under the First Amendment, then a pretextual prosecution is not necessarily a satisfactory solution either. I think there's another problem here as well, which gets to this issue of literature and ideology as it's looked at in the context of Islamic charities in the United States, which is that a lot of the literature in question is coming from our allies, the Saudis. And that in many instances, while we have a regime in which we have designations and we look at what's being distributed here and in other countries around the world, the root problem is in fact that the Saudi government has invested tens of billions of dollars in the propagation of precisely these ideologies. So in some instances, I think you have Treasury and Justice tying themselves up into knots because state isn't necessarily doing the work that it needs to do to hold a tougher line with the Saudis. To give you one lamentable, if somewhat comical, example of this, in the context of Al-Haramain, one of the officers of Al-Haramain was a man named Soleiman Al-Bouti, who was designated personally, and in the designation it said that he had direct links with Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. Now, Al-Bouti is living in Riyadh. I spoke to him for the piece. He's actually a mid-level functionary with the city of Riyadh, and he's somebody who we've designated, but it does bring in all kinds of enforcement issues. I mean, there was a funny instance recently in which he was actually invited in his capacity as a member of the government of the city of Riyadh to an event at the U.S. Embassy. And then when we realized that this was actually a designated individual, the invitation was quickly retracted. I asked him how he deals with having his assets frozen, And he said, oh, it's not a problem. You see, I just explained to the city of Riyadh my predicament, and they pay me in cash. So this is the way I deal with that. To conclude, just briefly, in terms of some things we should think about going forward, I really do think that that the relationship with the Saudis is a major issue, and that that's one where, in many instances, we wouldn't have to go through the kinds of contortions we do dealing with radical groups in the United States if, in fact, we would address this at the root cause. On the issue of direct links, which is very often the language that OFAC employs in making designations, I think that, one problem that I encountered as I was researching this story is that I tried to find somebody who could define for me direct links. So if you're a group and OFAC designates you, there will be a press release. And in some cases, this is quite inflammatory. It'll say there were direct links with Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. Now, it may be understandable that for reasons of sources and methods, OFAC and the United States government isn't in a position to furnish the precise intelligence that led to that judgment. But, nor would anybody actually explain to me what precisely direct links means. Is direct links 1 degree of separation? Is it 2 degrees? Can it be a principal-agent relationship where you have two people who don't actually ever interact, but they are, in fact, related through the hierarchy of an organization? I think it would be useful for the sake of transparency going forward, for the sake of the feeling that there is accountability for this process, and also for the sake of actually letting others know what is and is not permissible to define direct links. I looked around. It may be that indeed there is an internal definition that you can share with us, but I never came across one. I think, in addition to that, that some measure should be made to when designations are made to make a fuller statement of facts. I completely understand that there are limits on how much OFAC can say, but I think that it could be that we could get just 1 or 2 degrees more granular than we do. Simply in order for organizations that are designated to then figure out, what is it that we're being accused of here? How can we get delisted? How can we defend against this if indeed they believe that a mistake has been made? Those would be the major things I would think about going forward. But I'd love to hear the thoughts of others on the panel and discuss this. Thank you.
Good, Ori.
Good afternoon. I'm going to do my prepared presentation first, and I'll address a few of the points that Patrick raised. The bulk of what I want to talk about are court challenges in the United States to terrorist designations. And the bottom line message is that all of those designations have been upheld to date. And I think that's a product of the rigorous work that goes into our designation package in terms of compiling evidentiary information, undertaking legal review that our counsel's office does to ensure that the information we have compiled is both sufficient and meets the criteria of the executive order pursuant to which we're designating. That's the main message to keep in mind, which is all of the criticisms notwithstanding, the independent judiciary in the United States has repeatedly upheld these designations, and the courts, as I'll discuss, are privy to the entire evidentiary package, the classified and unclassified information as well. Before a party files a legal challenge, they are entitled to, but not required to, seek administrative reconsideration or delisting from OFAC pursuant to our regulations. And that provides an entity the opportunity to come in, present us with whatever additional evidence they believe demonstrates that they were erroneously designated. If it's really a delisting request after some period of time, perhaps to demonstrate that they've changed their behavior and should no longer be on our list. And whatever information they submit to us will become part of our record in the event that reconsideration request is denied and they choose to sue us in court. We will present to the court not only the administrative record, the evidence that we compiled in support of the designation, but also whatever evidence that party has sought to provide us. Judicial review in the United States is governed by two statutes. One is the Administrative Procedures Act, which is a general statute that provides that federal district courts can hear challenges to actions undertaken by federal agencies. And that's where OFAC designations are heard. There's also a separate statute that authorizes the State Department to designate groups as foreign terrorist organizations. And that statute also has a judicial review provision. Those cases go to the courts of appeals. But in terms of substance and the legal rules that apply, there's not much difference between the two regimes. In both cases, the court's review is based on the administrative record, as it is in other administrative law cases. That means that there isn't discovery. The parties don't go out and gather new facts and have a trial. Rather, the agency puts before the court, here's the evidence that we had before us upon which we based our decision. Again, if a party wants particular evidence heard by the court, it would have to come to OFAC first in its seeking reconsideration, and that would be part of the record before the court. And there's a rather deferential standard of review, which obviously helps in our undefeated record. And again, this is a standard that's taken from traditional administrative law cases, which is that as long as there was a rational basis for the agency's decision, it's going to be upheld. And so if...
Can you stop on that point?
Sure.
Can you explain to me what that means, rational basis test, how that gets applied, and what that says about the state of the evidence at that point? Can you just take a minute in laying that out? I think it would be very helpful.
Sure. I mean, I can quote from the APA, which won't be very, very helpful, but just to start, the Administrative Procedure Act, or the APA, sets out certain reasons why a court can set aside an agency action, in this case, overturn a designation. If it's arbitrary or capricious, arbitrary, i.e. it's not based on evidence, we just, you know, randomly picked somebody to designate. If it's an abuse of our discretion, it's or not in accordance with the law. So in the case of executive order designations, Executive Order 13224 provides specific criteria pursuant to which the Secretary of the Treasury can designate someone, providing material support to a designated party, acting for on behalf of a designating party. Not included in the statute, in the executive order, is distributing radical, communications. And if we were to designate an entity because we didn't like what they said, and the evidence we had in the administrative record was they said all these things that we find inflammatory, I'm quite certain that the court would overturn our actions, which they have not done to date because that isn't the basis upon which we designate. Can I just make one more sentence? That said, this isn't a case where we need to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this entity engaged in the conduct we're alleging, as would be the case in a criminal case, or, you know, beyond a preponderance of the evidence. There just needs to be, in the court's mind, enough evidence there that a reasonable person could reach the conclusion we've reached. I'm sorry.
Rumor has it that OFAC is like Perry Mason, and that OFAC has never lost a case. Is that right?
I certainly wouldn't say OFAC has never lost a case. I would say that none of the challenges, substantive challenges to terrorist designations in the United States have been successful, as far as I know, either OFAC designations or FTO designations.
Has OFAC ever lost a non-terrorist designation case?
I can't speak to the full scope of OFAC,
litigation
in the past 50 years.
Not to your knowledge.
We've had cases remanded on various issues. We actually recently lost a case that is on appeal with respect to a licensing matter. I mean, there's just such a wide range of things that we do in implementing sanctions that's beyond designating a party.
But on designations, never lost a case.
I'm not aware of that, but I can speak more confidently in the terrorism context because that's what I focused on for today.
Thank you.
And so back to the scope of review, which is this rational basis review, the idea is not for the court to decide what would I have done with this evidence. It's to decide was this a reasonable decision for the government to take. And although this is the traditional administrative law standard, there's some extra deference afforded to these actions because they are, in the words of the D.C. Circuit, at the intersection of national security, foreign policy, and administrative law. How that plays out, I don't know. Would the courts have ruled differently in any case if they didn't have this extra deference? I doubt it. But there certainly is a presumption of regularity to government action, as there is in other contexts, that's applied in these cases as well. And that standard of review, coupled with the robust evidentiary record we develop, I think is what's led to our successes to date. Now, courts have remanded, particularly in the foreign terrorist organization context, cases back to the State Department on procedural issues, due process type questions in terms of the process that's been followed in terms of providing notice to designated parties and the like. But with respect to the real meat of the issue, is there a reason to designate this party or this person? The courts have always found that the agencies have acted appropriately. And you know, this is not a judiciary that is always rolling over and, you know, rubber stamping whatever the government does in all contexts. I do think that that speaks to the integrity of our process. So with that background, I just wanted to touch briefly on some of the specific kinds of legal arguments that have been raised in these cases. The most common and the most basic, again, is to the sufficiency of the evidence. In the Holy Land Foundation case, Holy Land claimed that they weren't supporting Hamas, and the court rejected that, finding that the voluminous thousands and thousands of pages of the record demonstrate that they did, in fact, support Hamas and were founded by Hamas members. In the Islamic American Relief Agency case, the U.S. branch claimed that it wasn't a branch of the global organization based in Sudan, and the court rejected that claim, finding that the evidence showed that, in fact, they were a branch of the entity that was based in Sudan, which was the basis for the designation, that they had been represented themselves as such in the past in various fora and so forth. And on and on. In every case, in some cases, the courts give you more robust descriptions of the record. In other cases, less robust descriptions. But there's usually some summary there that explains why the court reached its decision based on the evidence that had been compiled. With respect to the use of classified information, after September 11th, Congress amended AIPA, which is the main statute that OFAC operates under, to expressly allow for us to submit classified information to the courts on an ex parte in-camera basis, meaning the other side doesn't get to see it, but the judge does, or the judges do. The FTO statute, the Foreign Terrorist Organization statute, has a similar provision. And so when these cases are litigated, the classified information is provided to the courts only and not to the other party, and that is part of the court's assessment of whether the action was rational. I will say, when you read these decisions, oftentimes the courts go out of their way to note that even the unclassified record was sufficient. That's not always true, but in many of the cases, there'll be a line in the opinion that says, you know, even the unclassified record alone would be sufficient to uphold this designation. I also want to point out that the Justice Department, which litigates these cases on our behalf, has a regulation that requires it, anytime it seeks to introduce classified information in court, this regulation requires the Justice Department to go back to the originating agency, which wouldn't be us, it would be whatever intelligence agency has provided us this information. The Justice has to go back to the originating agencies to determine whether the information at issue is still properly classified, which I think is, I'm surmising, I wasn't there when this regulation was crafted, but intended to ensure that to the extent that we are relying on classified information that's not being shared with the other party, that's being done in as narrow a way as possible and only with respect to information that still is appropriately classified. Many of these designation challenges have challenged the use of ex parte, the classified information, on due process grounds, and every court that has considered that in the United States to date has rejected those challenges, finding that due process is a malleable concept, you know, the amount of process that's due depends on all the facts and circumstances, and that requiring the government to reveal classified information would be too high a price to pay and not necessary in these cases. Some other legal issues that have arisen, this is a particularly U.S.-centric issue, is the question of whether our authorities reach U.S. entities, because the statute as written applies to the property of foreign persons. And the courts have held that we do have the authority to designate U.S. entities, such as Holy Land and the Global Relief Foundation, because their actions on behalf of these foreign terrorist organizations renders their assets property in which those foreign persons have an interest. The other kinds of claims that are raised are constitutional claims. Now, one important thing to note is that only persons with a U.S. presence are entitled to constitutional protection. So if you're a totally foreign party that's been designated by OFAC, you can come in, you can challenge your designation under the Administrative Procedures Act, but that's it. You don't get to raise constitutional due process claims or other constitutional claims. If you're in the U.S. or have some U.S. presence, then you do. And the primary challenge, the constitutional challenge, has been due process claims that relate to both the use of classified information, as I've discussed, as well as what sort of advance notice or any notice is an entity entitled to and an opportunity to be heard. And this is where the courts have sent some cases back for tweaking of procedures, to use a loose term, primarily in the FTO context. But the bottom line holding is that due process, again, is a malleable norm, and it depends on the facts and circumstances of the case, that although in a typical case, pre-deprivation process is required, i.e. you need to give somebody notice and an opportunity to be heard before you take action, there are exceptions to that rule, not just in this context, but in other contexts where there's some reason we're doing that would undermine your action. And I think asset freezing is a quintessential example of when providing advance notice would undermine the whole purpose of the blocking regime. And so courts have upheld not providing advance notice, but have held that to the extent a party has a U.S. presence, they do need to get notice of their designation, an explanation of the basis for the designation, and an opportunity to be heard. And in the OFAC context, that opportunity to be heard, again, is if you come in and seek reconsideration, we're going to show you the unclassified administrative record we relied upon. We're going to offer you the opportunity to submit whatever evidence you want, whatever arguments you want, and all of that will be considered. There's no requirement for a trial or the ability to call witnesses. And again, that's consistent with general administrative law principles.
Ori, does OFAC have any particular internal deadlines or calendaring system for these cases when somebody's requested a redesignation?
The first half of the question was, do we have
timing?
We don't have internal deadlines. We do have a calendaring system to the extent that that means keeping track of what's come in and when it's come in. But
there's no such thing as a speedy trial act, which requires you to get it done in a period of weeks or months or even years.
I think we'd be subject to whatever legal remedies any administrative agency would have with respect to the timing of its actions. But no, there's no set deadline. And I will say that's something we are focused on, is trying to move these things as expeditiously as we can. There's always a balance to be had in terms of resources with respect to addressing delisting petitions and working on new designations. But it's something that we recognize is very important to not let these things languish for years. Some of the other challenges that have been raised, just briefly, First Amendment claims have been raised in terms of, gee, you're freezing my assets, that means I can't give my money, and giving money is the equivalent of speech, and the courts have rejected those, saying, well, that might be true if you know, in the political context, but you have no constitutional right to support terrorism, so that's not a First Amendment violation. People have said these are associational violations, you know, violating my freedom of association, and the courts have rejected that because there's no prohibition on associating with a party. The prohibition is on the conduct that the designated party has engaged in, providing material support for a designated person or acting on their behalf. Similarly, expression claims have been rejected because designations have not been based on the expression of designated parties. Parties have raised religious freedom claims that somehow designating entities is infringing on their religious freedoms under the First Amendment. Those have also been rejected. Some U.S. parties have brought takings claims, claiming that this violates a constitutional prohibition against taking property. In those cases, those claims have also been rejected. When we block assets, this isn't a forfeiture, as in some, you know, drug cases, the Justice Department might come in and forfeit assets, which means their title actually vests in the United States. We're just blocking the assets. They are just frozen, but we haven't taken possession of them. And to date, courts have recognized that legal distinction in rejecting takings claims. I will note that one district court in dicta stated that the plaintiffs may someday have a credible argument that the long-term blocking order has ripened into a vesting of property in the United States. I think that would be a difficult argument to make legally, because as long as that blocking lasts, it wouldn't vest in the government. Title wouldn't vest in the government. But certainly, at least this district court thought that you know, long-term blockings might raise different kinds of issues than more temporary blocking orders. One case that we did lose that wasn't a challenge to a designation, but was a challenge to the terms of the executive order pursuant to which OFAC effects designations, and that executive order sets forth specific criteria that have to be met before a party can be designated. One of those criteria listed was if you were, quote, associated with a designated party. And that term was held to be unconstitutionally vague. And in response to that court ruling, OFAC issued a regulation providing a definition for the term. And that injunction was subsequently lifted. So the courts are paying attention. They are giving these cases, I think, very careful scrutiny. I just want to touch briefly on a couple of the points that were raised earlier. One was this notion that designations are an end run around the criminal process, that, you know, perhaps we're applying some litmus test that would be improper in the criminal case, for example, that a party is distributing radical literature and therefore, you know, you couldn't really convict them criminally based on that, but you could designate them based on that. You know, we have a legal construct that we operate under, and in the case of terrorism, it's the executive order I've referred to, and it sets forth specific criteria that have to be met before we can designate somebody. You need to be found to be acting for or on their behalf, to have provided them support, or to be owned or controlled by them, to be associated with them as now defined in our regulations. And we take those criteria very seriously, and when evidentiary packages are compiled and the summaries are drafted, they're always focused on those criteria. And our lawyers, who look at every package before it's finalized, make sure that the evidence, not just that there's sufficient evidence that this is a bad guy, but that there's sufficient evidence that this person meets one of the criteria in the executive order. And distributing radical literature, or, you know, being Muslim, or whatever else you might think might be going on, they're not in the executive order. They're not bases for our actions. We would never do that. Our lawyers wouldn't let it fly. The interagency process that includes the Justice Department and the State Department concurring in these designations wouldn't let it happen, and the courts wouldn't uphold them. So I can't really speak to the criminal prosecution of terrorists. I'm not a prosecutor. I'm not with the Justice Department. But I do think that some of the statements that were made are unfair in light of the record we've had. And the other point I'd like to comment on is this notion of direct links. And I know that statement was used in the Al Haramain press release, and I don't want to speak about the Al Haramain case because it's a subject of pending litigation. I don't know, and maybe you do, Patrick, and you've done the research, but you seem to suggest that that's language that's very frequently employed by OFAC. That's not my impression. I haven't gone back and read all our press releases, so maybe we do rely on it all the time, but I'm not sure that that's the case. I do agree with you. You know, you said it would be great if we had fuller statements of the case. And we make every effort to provide as much information as we can when we designate in a press release. And I hate the term press release because it sounds, you know, somehow belittling, but it is a press release. There's no doubt about it. Internally, we refer to this as the statement of the case. And that is a compilation of the unclassified evidence and the evidence that we were able to declassify to make public in support of a designation. And we do this for many reasons. I mean, one is that in terms of comporting with due process principles, obviously, the more you can say publicly, the better. The other is, you know, we want people to know that we're designating parties based on the things they've done that are bad, that meet the criteria of executive orders. And we don't want to issue press releases that just say this is a bad person or this is someone who's associated with Al-Qaeda. We would like to provide, to the extent we can, as much information as we can so that people have confidence in our designations. We have severe limitations in that regard because to the extent we're relying on classified information, it's not our decision in the end to make whether the information can be declassified, and there's real reasons to not declassify certain information. With that, I will conclude my remarks.
I want to just throw some questions up for later,
okay.
That I want you to be thinking about because I think it's pretty important. You've just described the domestic regime for due process with the rational relationship test?
Rational basis test.
Various other kinds of structures and safeguards. Interesting question would be OFAC's view, unofficially and informally, your view, as to whether that could be extended internationally in the event that it was necessary to preserve the concept of sanctions. I'm interested in everybody's views on that and whether it might potentially respond to the Al-Qaeda case. I also want to focus everybody on the fact that the Holy Land Foundation, which was suing me for defamation for congressional testimony I gave, in which I didn't mention its name but put it on a chart related to terrorist financiers after September 11th, was suing me for defamation on the day the president designated them, that the designation survived, but the criminal case against them went down in flames.
It's being retried.
It's being retried, but the original case went down in flames, which thus illustrates, I think, the difference between where we are in OFAC land and where we are in criminal justice land. I had no particular affection for the Holy Land Foundation. They were trying to destroy my ability to function as an attorney, as a professional in Washington, D.C., in response for constitutionally protected testimony, and retained a big, fancy, expensive Washington, D.C. law firm to do it. But the fact that the criminal case was lost is interesting and provocative, and it would be worthwhile, I think, talking about that and trying to understand the difference in standards. Those two questions on the record are probably enough. I've got another one which we'll save for later. Thank you. We're now going to turn to Christopher Michelson for his sense of where we are internationally.
Thanks, Jonathan. Welcome. Good evening. Or good afternoon, I should say. Firstly, I'd like to thank Ambassador Christian Vinaviza and Stefan Barrier for the kind invitation to come to Washington, also the Washington College of Law for having me. As you can see on the outline of today's schedule, my topic is court cases regarding international listing regimes, which to me is a very daunting task, not least because I think there are at the moment more than 26 legal applications pending before courts in Belgium, Italy, Switzerland, the Netherlands, Pakistan, Turkey, the United Kingdom, Germany, and the United States. So what I will do today is rather focus on cases that have been brought before the courts of the European communities, and I will pick up from what Stefan Marquardt said this morning when he explained the legal regime of in the EU, and will specifically deal with, obviously, with the case that has been mentioned number of times so far, the Qadi and Barakat Foundation appeals case that where the decision by the European Court of Justice was handed down last week on the 3rd of September. So what I will do is, firstly, I will explain briefly how it went, it got to the appeal. So I will briefly deal with the Qadi and Yusuf cases before the Court of European Court of First Instance. And we'll then talk about, briefly mention the advisory opinion that was issued by the EU Advocate General in January this year, which basically led to the judgment of the European Court of Justice in early September. And I will conclude then with a few general remarks on on the judgment and some implications, both judicial and political implications of the case, and I think we can then have also a chance to discuss this in more depth in session three. the Qadi and Yusuf cases before the Court of First Instance, basically what they were brought in December 2001. There were two actions under Article 230 EC and were brought against the regulation that I think Stefan mentioned this morning, number 881/2000, which implemented a 1267 regime, and it listed in its annex both Qadi and Yusuf. And basically the challenge brought by Qadi and Yusuf concerned two major points. First of all, the competence to adopt the regulation, and this is something that I will not get into any more detailed today, because I'm, as Jonathan also mentioned, I think in the introduction, I'm looking at it from a human rights perspective, and the competence question is a very technical question that would require lots of sort of explanations and as to the sort of provisions of the EC treaty. Suffice to say that the legal basis, as also Stefan mentioned this morning, was Articles 60, 301, and 308 of the EC Treaty, and basically, so the first part of the challenge focused on competence. Now, the second part of the challenge brought by Qadi and Yusuf focused on the violation of fundamental rights. Specifically, Qadi and Yusuf alleged the infringement of their right to use property, their right to a fair hearing, and the right to an effective judicial remedy. Now, you might wonder how are these sort of rights protected within the EU legal order, and I'd just like to make a very brief explanation in that regard. The case law of the European Court of Justice gradually build up a framework for human rights protections in the absence of any general provision in the EC treaty on the protection of fundamental rights. And only the Maastricht Treaty integrated the constitutional traditions and international human rights obligations of member states formally into the legal order of the EU itself. And it stipulates specifically in Article 6.1 of the EU Treaty that the Union is founded on the principles of liberty, democracy, respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms, and the rule of law. And it says in Article 6.2 that the Union is bound to respect fundamental rights as guaranteed by the European Convention on Human Rights and as they derive from the constitutional traditions common to the member states as general principles of community law. Now, this means that although no human rights treaty is directly binding on the EU and its institutions, both the Court of First Instance and the European Court of Justice normally rely on the European Convention on Human Rights when reconstructing general principles in the field. Now, with that in mind, I repeat that the challenges to fundamental in relation to a violation of fundamental principles include the right, again, to use property, the right to a fair hearing, and the right to an effective judicial remedy. The Court of First Instance handed down two nearly identical judgments in the cases of Qadi and Yusuf on 21st of September 2005, and basically found first that the Council had competence to adopt the regulation in question, but it also found that actually the Court lacked jurisdiction to review EC sanctions implementing Security Council Resolution 1267 because it had no jurisdiction to review the legality of the latter. It thus rejected all the pleas, and the challenges to the EU sanctions were rejected in the law, in light of the Court's interpretation of the relationship between the UN Charter and community law. And according to the Court of First Instance, although it was indisputed that the community is based on the rule of law and that all acts of its institutions may be reviewed by the Court, Article 103 of the UN Charter stipulates that member states' obligations under the UN Charter and Security Council resolutions prevail overall other conventional obligations, including under the EC Treaty and under the European Court of Human European Convention of Human Rights. Now, basically, sort of the court's line of reasoning implied two points. First, that the community itself, although not a UN member, is bound by obligations stemming from UN Security Council resolutions, specifically to the extent that the community member states are bound by such resolutions and must comply with them also in their dealings with the community. And this means that the community, in exercising its powers, is required to adopt all necessary provisions to allow its member states to fulfill their obligations, including their obligations to implement UN Security Council counterterrorism sanctions. In addition, the Court of First Instance found that the European Council, when adopting the contested EC Regulation 881/2002, was acting, and I quote, under circumscribed powers and had no autonomous discretion. And so the court considered, and I quote, that any review of the internal lawfulness of the contested regulation would imply that the court is to consider indirectly the lawfulness of Security Council regulations, given the origin of the illegality alleged by the applicant would have to be sought not in the adoption of the contested regulation, but in the resolutions of the Security Council, which imposed the sanctions. So basically it said the court has no option, no other option than to refrain from exercising any judicial review of the community measures, as it lacked power to judicially review the underlying Security Council resolutions, and then thus rejected the applicant's claims. The court, however, said, made one exception and said that it noted that the indirect exercise of judicial review of Security Council resolutions was still possible in cases of alleged violations of fundamental rights guaranteed by preemptory norms of international law, so-called jus cogens norms, in particular because these jus cogens norms had higher status, were non-derogable, and binding on all subjects of international law, including UN organs. So the basic question then was, to what extent does the right to property, so the alleged infringements that I mentioned earlier, to what extent do these rights constitute sort of jus cogens norms? And then the court undertook an analysis, basically reaching a conclusion that none of these rights amounted to jus cogens status. So this is very sort of a simplified explanation. Now, nowhere the court really made clear why it chose the jus cogens test, and this was also one aspect that had been or has been frequently criticized in sort of both academia and also other reports. Why sort of the court applied the jus cogens test and also the way it applied it. Basically, there are two other, just very briefly, this line of reasoning was also upheld by the Court of First Instance in two other judgments in the cases of 2006 decisions in the cases of Ayadi and Hassan. In both cases, the Court of First Instance substantially upheld the main line of arguments and findings of the Qadi and Yusuf judgments, but then developed a few aspects further. In particular, the Court of First Instance clarified that, and it is very, very important, that the right individuals have to diplomatic protection before the sanctions committee is enforceable before the domestic courts of the state in question, sort of dealing with the question, that sort of addresses the question whether this right to diplomatic protection amounts to an effective protection of the right of defense. I'm mindful of the time, so basically jumping ahead, the EU Advocate General, Prez Maduro, and then basically to say, Qadi and Yusuf went on appeal. In earlier this year, in January 2008, the Advocate General Juarez Maduro issued a very strong advisory opinion, basically suggesting that the European Court of Justice should set aside the whole judgment of the Court of First Instance. And it's fair to say, I think, while the court didn't quite go as far as was suggested by the Advocate General, it in fact did strike down the court of first instance decisions in Qadi and al-Barakat cases, and this is the decision handed down on the 3rd of September. Now, you may ask yourself, why was Qadi and Yusuf, and now it's Qadi and al-Barakat? The answer to that is that Yusuf was subsequently delisted and was no longer pursuing, obviously, the appeal. And so in the initial case, it was also Yusuf and al-Barakat, and so only al-Barakat, based in Sweden, remained. So that brings me to the recent decision. Basically, the court upheld the court of first instance judgment in as regards to the competence of the council to adopt the regulation in question, as also mentioned by Stefan this morning. And it said even if the court of first instance made certain errors in its reasoning, its final conclusion that the council was competent to adopt the regulation was not incorrect. But that's, I think it's fair to say that is a sort of about it as far as the agreement of the European Court with the Court of First Instance goes. And it says specifically, it then addressed the question as to whether the court has jurisdiction to review the EU regulation, the Council regulation implementing 1267. And basically the court said that the court of first instance erred in law in ruling that the community courts had no jurisdiction to review the lawfulness of the contested regulation. And the review by the court of the validity of any community measure in light of fundamental rights must be considered to be the expression in a community based on the rule of law of a constitutional guarantee stemming from the EC treaty as an autonomous legal system which may not be prejudiced by an international agreement. Basically, that is to say that the review of lawfulness ensured by the community courts applies to the Community Act intended to give effect to the international agreement at issue and not to the international agreement itself, which I think is a fairly smart move without saying really much. Or put it this way, I think it's very smart of the court because it keeps itself out of some trouble. But it's not quite clear as to sort of what the implications actually are of this. Anyway, a judgment given by the community courts deciding that a community measure intended to give effect to a resolution of the Security Council is contrary to a high rule of law in the community legal order, would not entail any challenge to the primacy of the resolution in international law. So the court very clearly differentiates between the international measure, i.e. the Security Council 1267, resolution and the act that implements this resolution within the EU legal order. As to fundamental rights, the second question, basically the court agreed with the applicants and basically held that all three rights were sort of put forward as infringed by Qadi and al-Barakat, there were indeed violations of these rights. The language of the court is quite strong in that regard, and because it says, and I quote, "The rights of the defense, in particularly the right to be heard and the right to effective judicial review of those rights, were patently not respected." So it's very strong language. And the court went on to say that the effectiveness of judicial review means that the community authority in question is required to communicate to the person or entity concerned the grounds on which the measure at issue is based so far as possible, either when the measure is decided on or at the very latest, as swiftly as possible after that decision in order to enable those persons or entities to exercise within the periods prescribed their right to bring an action. So basically the court acknowledges that in cases of asset freezing No advance notice might be given, or it may not be feasible or desirable to give advance notice, but it says, but the court says that in the absence of such advance notice is all the more important to communicate the grounds at a later stage. Basically, it said, the regulation at issue didn't provide any procedure for communicating the evidence justifying the inclusion of the names of the persons concerned in the list, either at the same time or, as I said, after that inclusion, because at no time did, in fact, the council inform Mr. Kadi or the Al-Barakat Foundation of the evidence adduced against them in order to justify initial inclusion of the names in the list. Briefly to the right, the infringement of Kadi and Al-Barakat's rights of defense also gives rise to a breach of the right to a legal remedy, inasmuch as the appellants were also unable to defend their rights in satisfactory conditions before the community courts. With regard to the third right, the right to property, the court held that freezing of funds constitutes an unjustified restriction of Mr. Kadi's right to property. The restrictive measures imposed by the regulation constitute restrictions of that right, which in principle could be justified, because as you may all know, the right to property is not an absolute right. However, the regulation in question was adopted without furnishing any guarantee enabling Mr. Kadi to put his case to the competent authorities, and such guarantee would have been necessary in order to ensure respect for his right to property, having regard to the general application and continuation of freezing measures affecting him. Which brings me basically to a brief conclusion and sort of a few comments, general outlook, what will happen next, or what are sort of the implications of that judgment. Some general remarks. I think it's very interesting to read this judgment simply for the tone of it. I think the court, I have the impression that the court actually was very annoyed by the cross appeals by like countries, for example, like the United Kingdom, suggesting that the court shouldn't have any role in reviewing the contested regulation, and so it's in several paragraphs and stages the court very strongly rebuts and rebukes this assertion and is actually asserting a very prominent role as far as judicial review is concerned. The second, I think, general remark is, as I said earlier, I think it's a very smart judgment in the sense that it's very difficult to criticize because it really only concerns itself with legal issues. So it doesn't touch any political implications, which I think any good judgment should do, but it makes it all the stronger. So I find it a very good and strong judgment in this regard. What are the judicial implications of the judgment? Well, first, the immediate impact of the court's judgments affects only the implementation of sanctions against the applicants. So at this stage, it only affects Mr. Kadi and Al-Barakat. It's important also, I forgot to mention, that the court maintains the effects of the regulations for a period of no more than 3 months, running from the 3rd of September, in order to allow the council to remedy the infringements found. But, of course, another point I would like to mention in, as far as judicial implications are concerned, is very interesting to observe that even in national cases, the approach taken by the court, which was also previously taken in a similar way by the Advocate General, has already made its way into the national judgments. And I'd like to just mention one case which was decided by the High Court of England and Wales. And that's the case of AKM, Q&G and Her Majesty's Treasury, which was decided on the 24th of April 2008 this year. And this case concerned a challenge to the national implementation of the 1267 regime. And if you read the High Court in this case, quashed the terrorism United Nations Measures Order 2006 and the Al-Qaeda and Taliban United Nations Measures Order 2006, which gave domestic effect to UN asset freezing obligations in relation to terrorism and Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And while it made clear that it was not bound by the conclusions by the Advocate General, the judge was very sympathetic to the line of argument and actually picked up on a number of sort of arguments made by the Advocate General, which were also subsequently followed by the court. So this is just one example, I think, where you can see that sort of the implications of sort of this judgment had effects on national cases, and probably there will be further cases in this regard. Now, just very briefly, finally, political implications. I think it's very difficult this regular, for political reasons, to upheld the Regulation 881/2002 implementing 1267 in the 27 member countries of the European Union. So it will be very interesting to see what's going to happen in the next 3 months. More generally, as I said, I'm coming to this from a human rights perspective, and I think this judgment by the European Court of Justice should really provoke a fundamental rethinking of the sort of approach taken in 1267. I think of the 1267 regime as a when I think about it, I always think about like a visit to the dentist. You know, if you have a problem with your root channel in your tooth, it doesn't help fixing the surface, even if it's a gold crown. And I think that's very much the case with the 1267 regime. I think it's now time, it should be now time to really rethink the whole approach as to whether the judicial review or right to legal remedy can be integrated. I mean, I don't want to take away anything of the discussion in session three, and I'm happy to make a few more points then. But I do think that the 1267 regime needs to be changed fundamentally if sort of the credibility of the UN counterterrorism efforts is to be maintained. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much. Very interesting perspectives. I learned a fair amount about what process exists and doesn't. One of the questions I have, because of the reformulation of what I asked before, is whether OFAC's due process procedures would meet the EU's concerns. And if so, would you litigate your case 28 times, or would once be enough? Would you get to do it once in the United States and once in the United Kingdom, or is the United Kingdom no good and you have to do it in the Continental Court? I can't answer those questions. I can just ask them. It's not clear from the opinion whether you litigate at the EU level necessarily, or then get a chance to litigate with every individual member state. And sometimes you're doing it multiple times. It can be successful. Didn't Al-Qaeda already get the Turks to say that the sanctions also were no good?
I
think he did. So that's my last sort of observation. Let's open up to questions. Comments, anxieties?
Thank you. Maybe touching upon your last remark and question, I had a question in my mind also directed at Ori. If I listened correctly to what you said, need for some of the review cases, in the administrative review that you had, your system allows the court to look at the evidence, but not ex parte, so the other party doesn't get to see it. Would that, I was not sure then from a presentation whether that kind of due process system is compatible with constitutional standards in the United States. And then one question indeed linked to the Caddy case and that comes to mind in that regard is that one problem the Council will be faced now is to to provide Cardi with a sufficient statement of case, and that will have to go through the, or is going through the 1267 committee procedure, and the state that has submitted the initial proposal will probably be asked to provide some elements or statement of case. And there, of course, then what the council is, that's the analysis of our lawyers, is requested to do is, before taking another decision, the council will most likely then communicate statement of case to the other party, and therefore, of course, then with the risk of that being publicly releasable or being made accessible to the public. And there, one question that, I mean, will probably arise for the European system as well, is that at the moment it's our system does not provide for any possibility of judges looking, or even maybe parties looking at you know, confidential information without it being made accessible to the public. I mean, that's something that might be thought about also in the European context, because that would, of course, then greatly facilitate the task of the judge. And I was interested, again, by the comment that indeed most of these cases, or all of them, have been upheld. But would they stand the scrutiny of a constitutional guarantee? That was one thing that was not so clear in my mind. Thank you.
Well, on that first and last point, the courts have upheld the ex parte in camera procedure against constitutional challenge for parties that are in the United States in the Holy Land case and in others. And what the courts have held is due process. You know, the Constitution just requires due process. And what does that mean? Well, it depends on the facts and the circumstances. And in these circumstances, the courts have held that it's sufficient to provide only the court this information. I think that conclusion is helped by the fact that Congress has chimed in both the IEPA and FTO context to say explicitly that this is how it should be done. So it's not just the executive claiming this, but I would point out that in other civil cases, the government on occasion submits classified information to the courts that the other side doesn't get to see. In criminal cases, there's a statute that Congress passed that governs the use of classified information and generally requires that a declassified summary be provided to the defendant. But I think it's understandable and reasonable to have different requirements and procedures in the criminal context where somebody's physical liberty is at stake than in the civil context. But the use of this information where only the judges get to see it has expressly been upheld against constitutional challenge repeatedly in the United States.
One of the interesting things that the Cotty case raises is the breakdown which we're seeing elsewhere in the EU in the privacy context of the exemption given states in the areas of national security and law enforcement. If you look at the underlying EU data protection directive from 1998, it says, you know, you have all these privacy rights, but they don't include that which is required by states in connection with law enforcement and national security, and that's an exemption from your obligations under the directive. And over the last couple of years, the human rights and privacy advocates have pushed at that, saying, well, that's right within the EU, but that doesn't mean we can give any credence or any weight to national security or law enforcement imperatives of non-EU states. So if it's, by chance, the United States that has a national security or law enforcement concern, like wanting passenger information to protect against terrorism, to want that automatically, we don't have to give that any respect whatsoever. That is not an exemption under the directive and doesn't count. It would if it was Belgium against France, but not France against the United States. Therefore, that exemption is not proper, and you have to have privacy rights, human rights standards attached to all of the data that's transferred in that connection. So once you have basically broken that barrier of exempted activity for governments, it gets to be very interesting to see where it goes. One obvious area it's gone already is taking property away without due process. Well, what about your right to travel? Well, Interpol does that all the time when Interpol takes requests of member states, such as China and Russia, and issues red notices, often in response to utterly politicized notices by governments and essentially makes it impossible for people to travel. There is no right to be heard at Interpol, despite the fact that Interpol is located in Lyon, France, and its constitution requires Interpol not to violate the human rights of any person and guarantees such persons a right of appeal. Well, you appeal, and what Interpol does is scratch its head and say, yes, you're right, there is in theory an appeal, but look, there you are on that list, and we don't make any adjudication of any kind. All we're doing is passing the information on. So it's not our responsibility. This remains under review by Interpol. It's another interesting example of where the principle takes us in international law. Member states of the UN have obligations under the Treaty on Corruption, the Treaty on Narcotics, the Vienna Convention of 1988, and the Palermo Convention of 2000, to cooperate with other states through mutual legal assistance, not even on the basis of bilateral agreements, but simply on the basis of that multilateral agreement. So if the government of France suddenly comes to the United States and asks for all kinds of information on me, Jonathan Weiner, everything the United States government may have or can get, I don't have any right to say, no, wait a minute. The French are doing this because I was unkind to them in print. I've been very critical of Sarkozy. I refer to him as shorter than I am, and not deserving of that beautiful woman. And if the French came on that basis and asked the United States under a mutual legal assistance agreement for stuff on me, alleging any of the broad number of offenses listed, I have no standing to be told about it, let alone to appeal it. Now, the principles in the Cotty case, it seemed to me, are the same principles that would justify my having an absolute right any time the United States has asked for information on me, for me to be notified by it and to be able to take it to court before the United States cooperates. Same principle. So you can go very, very far with these principles in validating cross-border cooperation. What I spent the 1990s on in my work for the U.S. government was trying to build cross-border cooperation because of the threat to sovereignty created if a human activity crosses borders willy-nilly and government jurisdiction stops at the border's edge. One fascinating thing to see is that human rights may now be triumphing as a way to constrain the extension of state sovereignty across borders. Now, that may be a wonderful protection for human rights, but it may also be costly in some other areas where state sovereignty may be something that is useful. Comments?
Well, I think you raised so many points that I'm not even sure where I should answer, where I should start to answer. But it's just one point. I think when it comes to both the right to privacy and the right to property, both rights are obviously not absolute rights. And I don't know what the legal basis is for Interpol red alerts or Interpol. I'm also not familiar with the exact contents of a sort of treaty of mutual legal assistance, but I do think that both of these sort of arrangements can be human rights compatible. It's just a question of proportionality. And I think, as I said, both the right to privacy and the right to property are not absolute rights. And so even if there's no, as the European Court of Justice said in Cardi, even if there's no advance notice given to Mr. Cardi or Al-Barakat, this requires an ex post provision of evidence. So I don't quite see why human rights do sort of present a challenge to the things you mentioned.
The way in which it works in mutual legal assistance is there is a remedy. Individual nation states can simply refuse to provide the mutual legal assistance on the basis that their national interests are threatened. And the national interest exception is viewed to include human rights. So they have the right on their own say-so to simply decide in a particular case not to cooperate. That's essentially the difference. But they don't have an obligation to provide notice, hearing, or any kind of process. In the case of Interpol, I've represented now several different people, including in one case somebody who works for an NGO who's in the field of human rights, who have had their right to travel dramatically interfered with by Interpol red notices issued for political and improper reasons by members. And I can tell you there is no due process. Interpol has been warned by the EU that there are problems with this and has been unable to solve it, which raises the question in this context as to whether there will be a solution for the EU here or whether we are seeing the end of targeted sanctions in the European Union and therefore essentially in the world. And that's the question. And hopefully the next panel will have answers that will protect us from the abyss.
I wonder if you could say something about what we might expect as the Council tries to deal with the errors identified in CADI in terms of what due process might look like, especially with regard to classified material. I mean, is there a precedent in the EU context of something like the solution that U.S. courts have seemed to accept, or should we expect something radically different?
I think that's the million-dollar question, and probably the question that the legal service of the Council is trying to get a grip of as we speak. Thinking about the judgment, I think the only thing the court said in that regard was actually that it referred to the Shahal case of the European Court of Human Rights of 1996, basically just saying that national security cannot be a ground alone for sort of restricting human rights. To what extent, you know, specific or sufficient avenues of legal remedy and sufficient process of judicial reviews are concerned, I simply don't know. I mean, I don't know whether the legal team is considering, for example, the proposals made by, say, the Watson Institute in their 2006 report by the criteria put forward by the Secretary General in a non-paper, I think, of 2006, whether it's dealing with the proposal that was put forward by Liechtenstein, Switzerland, Sweden, Germany, and others in May this year. It's just very hard to guess, and I think I'm not in a position to sort of second guess what sort of these specific remedies would look like.
Although, Professor Michelson, you did say that the opinion said that judicial review was absent, and that was a fatal flaw, and the right to be heard was absent, and that was a fatal flaw. So that would apply a requirement for some form of either EU-wide or individual member state judicial review and a formal process with the right to be heard and to submit information.
That's correct, but the court didn't go as far as to suggesting how this specific review should look like. It's basically just said it's absent. But I think it's rightly so. I think it's not for the court to suggest what a sort of sufficient judicial review should look like, because this is a decision for the Council to make.
Well, we have time for one more summing up, so I would certainly like to see if Patrick has further thoughts over the course of this panel.
No, except that I do feel as though, to the extent that there's a kind of a continuity in these discussions of how these issues play out domestically and internationally, it's this issue of being able to confront, for the accused to confront, or for some independent body to review the evidence. And I think, I mean, I absolutely point well taken that in the domestic context, when these designations are taken up before a federal judge, the judge does get to examine all of the evidence. I think that there are still objections brought by parties that have been designated, saying that they're not able to directly bring evidence. You know, I suppose indirectly they are, insofar as they put something in the administrative record that then goes through OFAC to the judge. But it does seem as though, in the international context, and through the UN procedures, the fact that the United States is not necessarily going to be able to or willing to furnish whatever intelligence it is that forms the basis of the evidence is going to be a continuing problem.
Ori, has the U.S. government started any interagency process to think about responses to the CADI case internationally?
I'm not the right person to answer that question. I'm sorry.
Well, perhaps the U.S. government is smart enough to take your expertise and apply it more generally. With that, I think we'll end this panel and look forward to the next one. Thank you very much.